Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Our interview today marks another anniversary for our podcast. It is our 300th unique episode that we've recorded throughout the roughly 6 years we've been doing this. No birthday cake today, though, as I think I'll save that for when and if we get to our 500th in a few years. Nonetheless, I do want to thank Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion for supporting us through all these years, and the folks who have been loyal listeners. In the past few months, we've noticed an uptick in the number of individuals interacting with our site, sending us messages via Facebook and Twitter, and also we want to thank the folks at Real Clear Religion for all their support and mentioning us on a weekly basis. Thank you guys out there. You're great. If you are listening to our show today, please take a moment to suggest our free educational series to a friend or a colleague and help us spread the word, as we always love the company. With that said, today's guest is Dr. Niall Green, a professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he held the prestigious William Andrews Clark Chair and was also the founding director of UCLA's Program on Central Asia. Professor Green began his career as a historian of India and Pakistan, serving as a research fellow and instructor at such institutions as the University of Manchester, Oxford University, and St. John's College at Cambridge. Over the years, Niall has expanded beyond India and Pakistan into the broader topic of what he calls the multiple globalizations of Islam, tracing Muslim networks that connect Afghanistan, Iran, the Indian Ocean, Africa, Japan, Europe, and even America. Niall has written several dozen articles and book chapters in various academic outlets and is the author of several books, including Indian Sufism Since the 17th Century, Islam and the Army in Colonial India, Making Space, Sufis and Settlers in Early Modern India, Bombay Islam, the Religious Economy of the West Indian Ocean, 1840 to 1915, which was the winner of several book awards, The Love of Strangers, What Six Muslim Students Learned in Jane Austen's London, and most recently, Terrains of Exchange, Religious Economies of Global Islam. All of these books will be linked on our website if you are interested in further readings following today's interview. Niall, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be talking to you and your listeners, and thanks for making your way through that long bibliography.
I noticed on your you originally had the William Andrews Clark Chair and the founder of the UCLA Program on Central Asia. I'm always amazed that people have such huge titles and how they ever would fit it on a business card.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, need a longer one, I guess.
Yeah, I keep it simple. They just call me Professor or Hey You, and it fits on one of those little tiny cards. So that makes it simple. Today, our focus is going to be on the multiple globalizations of Islam, as you call it, and we're going to particularly emphasize your work on South Asia. But when I was going through your curriculum vitae, I was stunned to see a book about Muslim students and Jane Austen. Two things that I probably wouldn't naturally put together. So tell us a little bit about that work. How did it came about, and what is it all about?
Well, the book's a story, really, about the first group of Muslim students that ever came to study in Europe. There were six of them. They were all from Iran, and they turned up in London in 1815. In the midst then, in the very time when Jane Austen was writing and publishing her novels. And what's fascinating about this bunch of six young men, six young Taliban, as they call themselves, six young students, the word literally means, is that one of them left a diary in Persian that had never been translated before. And that diary, talking about what those half a dozen young men got up to in their period of 4 years in London, a kind of like an undergraduate degree today, it gave us really an insight into British history in a period that's actually so important for the beginnings of imperialism, for the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, for the Romantic movement, of course, in European literature, and a period that is actually hidden rather than revealed by Jane Austen's novels. So the Diary of Mrs. Sally in the book I wrote about these kind of six young men really helps us look through the hedgerows at Pemberley, as it were, you know, the famous country house in Pride and Prejudice, and see a much more international and globalizing Britain in that period. And more importantly, I think, it tells us the story of the earliest substantive modern contact between Muslims and Europe. And what I tried to do in telling that story about this group of six young men who were effectively Europhiles, they fell in love with Europe, they fell in love with the culture of the Enlightenment, they fell in love with Europeans, with men and women, with friends and indeed a wife that one of them took back home with them. What's important about that narrative, I think, it gives us a very different etiology, a very different genesis story for the beginnings of European and Muslim relations in the modern period. And that's that story I wanted to tell. Not a different myth, but a different history, a different historical narrative about how European and Muslim relations began in the modern period.
How did you stumble across this diary? Was it hidden in somebody's attic and you were just walking around and said, oh, here's a interesting thing. It's written in Arabic or Persian and, you know, oh my gosh. Or where did you find it?
Well, I guess the scholarly equivalent of rooting around in the attic. I was looking around in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, where I used to live, and then in the library in Manchester, where I used to work for a while. And I found the original manuscripts of the writings of Mirza Saleh, the student who wrote the diary, and other records of his travels as well, and some printed, untranslated, some printed Iranian editions of the library, and his diary. And that really captured my imagination, because it really opened up a world that I knew myself so well. I mean, I'd studied in London, I'd lived in Oxford, I'd studied in Cambridge, and Mirza Saleh and these students were all in exactly these places at the same age as I was. And for me, in a way, it was almost like kind of walking through a geography that I knew very well, a British geography, obviously where I'm from, but opening up an absolutely hidden and forgotten Muslim psychogeography in precisely those places. And a geography, I think, that really, again, is really important because it helps us reveal the Muslim engagement with the thought that emerged, the scientific thought and the political thought, the liberal thought that emerged out of the European Enlightenment. But yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, I did what scholars do. I was kind of rooting around in a library. For me, it was a bit different because most of my projects actually have come out of my travels to, you know, various parts of the Islamic world and actually kind of finding, you know, kind of documents and materials on site. So this was a bit of a turning point for me, really. Perhaps the onset of middle age, I don't know. Well, anyway, you know, kind of different projects have different points of origin.
Yeah, that's a really important lesson for a lot of our young scholars out here. Even though you have a project in mind and you're very focused on it, you'll be walking around in different places and topics always suggest themselves, always on the periphery. And you have to be open to saying, hey, that might be something interesting, and picking it up and running with it, which seems like what you did there.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, for young scholars, I think it's really important that they, as it were, begin with and follow the evidence, I think. That's something I've always done in my career. I haven't, as it were, followed the secondary literature and taken up some debate or argument. I've begun with primary sources, often taken in situ, and worked from there, rather than, as it were, trying to sort of, as it were, continue some debate in the literature. Because I think if we don't do that, we never are able to break the hermeneutic loops that exist in any academic discipline.
Yeah, no, they're very true. And what you're doing with that book, too, that diary that you came across, you're finding out that there's a period in the 19th century, this period of modernity, where two worlds are somewhat colliding, and that is what most of your research is on here, a lot of it occurring in India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and beyond. One of the questions I always like to ask is how scholars come about the main research agendas that they take up in their careers. And for you, you know, you're growing up, you go to college. How did you decide to follow this path as you did?
Well, for me, it began actually before I went to college. When I was 17 in my high school summer holidays, I got on a train to Istanbul. And, you know, as things happen to at that age, it really blew my mind. And the following year, I traveled back to Turkey in the summer between high school and college, and I traveled around Eastern Turkey, you know, kind of historical Kurdistan, and I kind of spent nights in cheap hotels on the border of Iran. I actually wandered across the Iranian border and I, you know, hung out in these hotels that were literally full of smugglers wandering across the border from the Iranian side of Kurdistan. And that really set me on a trajectory throughout my 20s and 30s of traveling every year without fail, sometimes for 6-9 months at a time even, to many countries in the Muslim world. Ultimately, I've worked, traveled, researched in around 20 Muslim countries and communities, whether Yemen, Iran, or Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, Syria, many different places. And for me, that really kind of created, I had no plans to become an academic. I became an academic simply as a way of sustaining my interest in that part of the world, as a way of actually just making an excuse for the travels I wanted to continue doing. And really, but gradually and incrementally, that kind of set up a methodology for me, really, that what I tend to call walking history, of actually going to places, and as I've mentioned, trying to find material there. Once I, you know, I fitted in some degrees along the way and learned some languages. And actually, in many ways, although I've written as a historian, actually settled down into the role of being a historian, I don't have a history degree of any kind. I actually kind of, in a way, kind of saw myself more as an anthropologist and an ethnographer. And now I tend to write as a historian, as really see myself as a social scientist, someone really kind of bridging between anthropology and history. And that very much came out, as I say, for my experience of learning about the Muslim world through being in it, and not primarily through sitting in a seminar room.
Yeah, that definitely comes across in all of your writing, that you're a social science of this, not just a historian. That I see sociology and a bit of economics in here as well, which is makes it for great reading and understanding the worlds that you're examining through different perspectives. You talk about walking history, though, but here's the question. A lot of your research focuses on the 19th century, and I'm pretty sure you're not that old to have been walking around in the 1800s. So what brought up the fascination with that period of time?
In fact, I mean, I started my earlier degrees were actually in medieval history, and my doctorate was actually in early modern. And it was only in my kind of postdoctoral period that I began to take an interest in the 19th century. And the reason was twofold, really. I think on the one hand, and again, sort of empirically driven, on the one hand, I started reading these Urdu texts and Urdu hagiographies, in fact, stories of saints, kind of popular texts that were from the 19th, early 20th century, and they were full of these stories of encounters. It wasn't just, as it were, an old Mughal Empire, sort of more of a closed Muslim world that I'd worked on for my PhD. These were texts that were about encounters between Britons and other Europeans and Indians and Muslims. And that kind of really fascinated me. And on the other hand, although it's absolutely true that of course, you know, I can't step back into kind of a historian's time machine. There is, though, in a sense, a time machine around us in many cities like Bombay and indeed like London and many cities I've worked on. That is, of course, is the material record of the built physical environment that emerged in that period. So many of the cities, particularly the global cities of the world today, whether New York, London, Bombay, Singapore, Hong Kong, Yokohama, one can go on, are really products of the globalizing 19th century. So in that way, again, you know, kind of, even though I couldn't step into a time machine, you know, kind of, there was a kind of, as it were, material record that I could indeed walk through.
Yeah, I have a similar interest in that period of time, mostly here in the Western United States. I'm a big fan of cowboys and Western history and things like that. And the 1800s were neat because there was enough written documentation and other types of materials to really focus our interest on a lot of the main things that were going on, but not so much noise as perhaps we have today in the internet world, that it distracts us from a lot of things. So it's just this really unique period of time that just captures my imagination as well.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's another important point, really. I mean, that drew me to this period in these materials, because we have more, as though we call it in South Asian history, subaltern voices, you know. And of course, you know, the history of the U.S. West is, of course, precisely that. All of the, you know, kind of tin miners and women that turned up, and of course Chinese miners and immigrants, all kinds of people. So I think in the Islamic world too, the 19th century, we start to get documentation that allows us access to voices and stories and social groups that are really much, much harder to reach for earlier periods. So that's a great point, Tony.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. And you mentioned Bombay, and I want to focus on your book on Bombay Islam and move it a little bit farther afield as well, because I can see your scholarship focusing there, but then expanding outwards in many directions. That book, Bombay Islam, sets out to understand an interesting paradox in the Indian religious landscape that traditional sociological models would not typically predict. And we want to examine that, but before we do, let's set the table as to what India, and in particular Bombay, looks like in the early to mid-19th century or so. I think you pick up your story around the 1840s and take it through the early part of the 20th century. So what's going on in India and Bombay at this time?
Okay, well, if I step back a little bit further, even quite a bit further, to say around the year 1000 AD, we have a period from around 1000 AD, the late 10th century, when various Muslim dynasties, often of Turkic ethnicity or Central Asian ethnicity, these Muslim dynasties start to expand across India. Now, by the time that the East India Company is founded, and the British East India Company is founded in 1600, most of the Indian subcontinent is ruled by the Muslim elites of the Mughal Empire. Now, from around 1750, when the East India Company starts to be transformed from being a trading company to being a political entity, it starts to expand its political control in order to protect its commercial interest, in fact. What the landscape, and indeed the political landscape it's taking over, is largely being taken over from Muslim rulers. Now, the East India Company has, as it emerges kind of piecemeal across India, as its control expands, it has three port city centers, which it calls presidencies. One of them is Calcutta, which until the early 20th century will be the capital of British India. The other is Madras, now called Chennai, in southeastern India. And the third one is Bombay, since renamed Mumbai, but the language, all my sources in the various languages call it Bombay, so I'm going to stick to that. The third of these is Bombay. Now, Bombay comes into the East India Company's, into British hands, in the year 1661. It actually originally belonged to the Portuguese in India, and it was largely developed as a Portuguese city. There'd been an earlier Hindu temple there in a village, the temple to Mumba Devi, which gave the city its name, at least according to one etymology. But effectively, what was really interesting to me about Bombay was, in a sense, it was a bit like a tabula rasa. It presented me as a historian with a city that wasn't one of the earlier Muslim centers that had emerged in the earlier 1,000 years of Muslim rule. As a result, before the coming of the British, and particularly before the British really started to expand Bombay in the 19th century, it had no large Muslim institutions, it hadn't had a particularly large Muslim community, it wasn't indeed a significant city at all. So sociologically, as a historian, it represented the closest thing, I think, in terms of a large city that one could find to, as it were, a control experiment, a city that came of age in the period of British colonization, but thereby also of a kind of imperial globalization. So in the period that I talk about in my book, from 1850 to 1915, in around 1850, the city of Bombay had around 100,000 Muslims resident in it. By 1901, according to the census, it had 155,000 Muslims. These numbers then may not sound so significant now when we look at the mega cities of Asia today, but they were constituted around 20% of the population of Bombay. And that's pretty much representative of what the Muslim population across the rest of the Indian subcontinent was at that time, of course, before the division into Pakistan and India and so on. So the religious landscape of Bombay is full of all different kinds of people. This 20% group of Muslims who are themselves divided into many different ethnic and religious groups with their different leaders, their different customs, indeed their different languages and their different modes of dress. And of course, all these various other, the different Hindu religions, the Parsi Zoroastrians, and as we'll see later, the European Christians, and indeed the earlier Goan Indian Christians, Catholics as well, coming into the mix. Now, it wasn't only that that interested me then, this kind of cosmopolitanness of Bombay. What interested me in Bombay as well was that it becomes a center of migration, and that's why my book is not only about India. It's actually not, so, like so much Indian history, is written in this sort of nationalist, methodological nationalism. We just look at this thing called India as if this nation-state has always existed with its closed borders, its defined modern borders. My book is about placing India in the Indian Ocean world. So when we look at Bombay, it's really at the interface between India and, indeed, the Indian Ocean world of the Middle East and Africa. So migrants were moving into 19th century Bombay from its continental hinterlands, that's to say within the Indian subcontinent itself, but also from its oceanic hinterlands, whether from East Africa, whether from the Arab states in the Gulf, or indeed from Iran, and in some cases Afghanistan as well. So we have this cosmopolitan mix of what we might recognize as a modern globalizing city. And the reason why that globalization is going on is another reason that's really kind of linked up with the forces of globalization today in terms of commerce and industrialization. And that's the final thing that really drew me to Bombay in a big way. That Bombay was a really major and pioneering center of industrialization, not just in the Islamic world, but in Asia altogether. Bombay has the first steamship in 1825, the first steamship anywhere in Asia. It has the first train service anywhere in Asia in 1853. It has some of the earliest factories and indeed the earliest industrial labor force. Perhaps we can talk about the earliest Muslim proletariat emerging in Bombay. It has the telegraph very early, the international telegraph, and it has probably the earliest and largest and most diverse vernacular language printing industry anywhere, not just in India, but in the Indian Ocean world. And that interested me in drawing me to Bombay because it allowed me to not look at this kind of somewhat airy and insubstantial term modernity, whatever that is, as if it's some state of mind or so protean and hard to pin down. It allowed me, as a social historian and a social scientist, to look at much more tangible and concrete processes of industrialization and was able to measure them, whether all this industrialization added up to this state of mind we call modernity or whether it led to something quite different.
You mentioned the Muslim proletariat emerging. This is a period of industrialization. Tell us a little bit about the 100,000 or so Muslims that are existing at this time. Are they mostly blue-collar workers? Is it a mix of some merchants and blue-collar workers? Are they owners? Who are they?
Yeah, they're a very wide mix. I mean, at that point in Bombay does have some very wealthy Muslim merchants. The factories weren't all owned by, you know, kind of fat British capitalists. Some of them were, and some of them were owned by perhaps fat Indian Muslim capitalists. You know, there's a range. You know, there's a range of Muslims, from wealthy Muslims, of course, the greater majority being migrants to the city, as indeed people are today, who were working in the factories, working in the dockyards, and some of the poorest of all were East African, Black African Muslims, who had the lowest jobs of all, who worked coaling, often loading coal into the engines of the steamships. So there's this kind of a whole range of Muslims in the city with their different cultural lives, their different levels of literacy and education, their different cultural tastes, and of course their different amounts of capital, the different salary levels in their pockets, which, as we'll see as we go on in our conversation, perhaps becomes important.
Now, one of the things that happens during the 19th century with this industrialization is the rise of modern social science. And we got the folks like Max Weber, Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, as well as some developments in economics as well. And they're looking at the world of religion, and they're predicting that with modernization, industrialization, and I don't think they might have used the term at the time, but globalization, there's going to be some changes in the religious landscape. And that's what your book, Bombay Islam, really focuses on. So what are we seeing and what is happening with the religious landscape along with this cosmopolitan city and industrialization?
So in theoretical terms, what I was interested in doing with taking on this case study of Bombay was really trying to test and indeed challenge the really long-standing sociological shadow of Max Weber in the world of Islamic studies, the scholarly study of Islam and Islamic history. Because Max Weber's famous hypothesis, let's add it up, let's sort of sum it down to one word, Entzauberung, which is to say disenchantment as we translate it in English, but of course the German word literally means taking the magic out of the world, getting rid of the miracles and all of these kind of aspects of an enchanted world, enchanted forms, magical forms of religiosity and magical thinking in a sense. That idea had a very, very long currency in the study of religious movements in the Islamic world and particularly in South Asia, right through to the end of the 20th century, and indeed still does today. Because that idea was that, well, following Weber's trajectory, that modernization is going to lead to religious reform is going to lead, in a sense, to a kind of Protestant-like religiosity. Various scholars have written about the emergence of a Protestant Islam, a reformist Islam in the 19th century that is more scriptural, that is more bookish, that is disenchanted, very much in Weber's terms. And that kind of model has really dominated the scholarship to the point that the vast majority of the studies of Islam in the 19th century, whether in South Asia or elsewhere in the Islamic world, really focus on these Weber-like reformist groups. Now, that's something I wanted to challenge, because when I looked at the evidence for Bombay, sure, I did indeed find evidence of Muslim reformists, and that's precisely, of course, what Weber's ideas and Weber's followers would expect us to see. After all, Bombay is, I'm not going to use the word most modern, this abstract term, but Bombay is the most industrialized environment in anywhere in India and indeed in the Islamic world in this period. It's the place where you have more printing than anywhere. Surely this would add up to a Protestant, scripturalist, disenchanted Islam. And as I say, indeed, I did find examples of that. There were a number of Anjumans, reformist associations, voluntary associations, very much founded on the model of European voluntary associations. The word was a kind of a neologism. And these were founded by wealthy, educated merchants or senior bureaucrats in the British civil service, figures like Badruddin Tayabji. And these were indeed interested in promoting and inculcating a reformist, textualist, scripture-based Islam that is indeed was in many ways much more modernist as well, embracing women's education and other aspects of social reform. But as I looked more broadly at the broader communities, the Muslim communities in the plural of Bombay, I found a whole range of different religious groups, different religious forms, that seemed to add up to a lot more different religious firms and actually a lot more people, a lot more followers than the reformists. I added up, I categorized these under the labels of the not just the Anjuman, the reformist, but also the Jama'at, the community type of organization. The Hoja Ismailis were one of these. And so you'll be born into this community and you have, as it were, one community head, the Agha Khan in their case. Another form of religious firm, and indeed a form of religious activity and organization, the Brotherhood, I called it, taken from the Sufi term, the Tariqa. Case studies I looked at, Safi Ali Shah from Iran, an immigrant, Habib Ali Shah, an immigrant from India, from the continental hinterland. And even more importantly, the types of religious firm that I called shrines, dargahs, as they're usually called in India. And these are places of popular pilgrimage that interestingly drew Hindus as well as Muslims, and in some cases, Christians to the city as well. One of the most fascinating characters I look at that the saints buried in these shrines is a figure called Pedro Shah. As you can tell from his name, Pedro, of course, it's a Hispanic name. And indeed, he was said to have been a Portuguese Christian who converted to Islam and thereafter became a saint. Now, what I argued ultimately was by looking at the evidence for these much wider range of religious organizations, religious firms, as I call them, that were far greater in number and far greater in the number of followers than the reformists that Weber would have predicted, and that had been focused on, of course, by the majority of scholars until, indeed, even today, was that I called it all these other forms of religious activity, customary Islam, and that I argued that actually that added up to what I termed a religious economy of enchantment. And it was actually, moreover, the very forces of modernization, what I call industrialization, that's to say the coming of new forms of transport technology, the new coming of new forms of communication technology, particularly vernacular printing, the new forms of religious organization adapting from the Christian missions. So these very 19th century new innovations, these were just as modern as reform and just as modern as Weber's Entzauberung, his disenchantment. But what they added up to, in fact, was a religious economy in which the enchanters were actually much more effective and successful. In short, then, a religious economy of enchantment.
Yeah, the religious economy angle that you bring into your work is obviously very interesting to me, since I'm somebody who's been doing that for many decades here. And I just have to ask, how did you stumble across this kind of model of religious economy?
Partly through the reading and being inspired by works such as your own and other pioneers. I'm very much in the second wave, or probably even the third wave, or even beyond of scholars to become up on religious economy. But I believe I'm pretty well the first to adapted to the study of Islam. And I think that's really crucial. Yeah. We need sociological models to understand what's going on in the Muslim world and indeed in Europe today. We might come back to that. In my case, with regard to Bombay, the core principles of religious economy that I tried to take up, the core principles and the core analytical terms and apparatus of that model were quite simple, but absolutely devastatingly analytically useful, I think, models of forces of demand and forces of supply. And this, to me, made all of the difference when looking at Bombay the way I did, compared to, I think, the way looking at religion in South Asia and indeed throughout the Islamic world the way it usually is. Because most scholarship on the study of religion, without knowing it, focuses only on the supply side. Some guy, some imam, some Sufi, some reformist, some whatever they are, comes along and opens a mosque or writes a book of theology or prints, a book or whatever it is. That's just the supply side. Yeah. And if we're only writing history on that side, we don't know, well, was there a rapport with demand in the market? Were the followers, did this catch on or not? So we can never understand religious history through only looking at the supply side. It was as if I'd written about the history of Bombay by saying, well, Badruddin Taibji comes along and found his reformist Anjuman, end of story.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do was actually use religious economy to look at the whole marketplace, so not just look at one group, just the reformists, to look at all of the competing figures in the marketplace. And of course, when you're looking holistically, as religious economy teaches us, to look at an entire zone that it, of course, conceptualizes as a religious marketplace, we have to bring in not only the suppliers and the diverse types of suppliers there might be in a city like Bombay. We also, of course, crucially have to factor in the forces and indeed the people of demand, the people who are going to choose and select and choose to follow or choose to reject different religious suppliers. And of course, that demand that's generated through, of course, the vast number of, there are far more demanders, there are far more consumers in any religious marketplace than there are suppliers, as in any kind of economy. That interplay between the forces of supply and demand is what actually kind of shapes religious history. So with regard to the forces of supply, what I saw going on in Bombay were forms of innovation and adaptation by religious entrepreneurs, and we can perhaps talk about more of those in a moment, the foundation of new types of effective religious firms, and as I've discovered that the reformist religious firms, in fact, weren't the most effective. The most effective religious firms were religious firms that as it were, marketed products and services that were familiar and recognizable to the majority of people in the marketplace. They were customary, they were traditional, they were customary in terms of miracles and enchantments and the kind of help and talismans and pilgrimages that people were familiar with. But, and this is really what's crucial, these were entrepreneurial and highly effective new types of religious firm because they propagated and printed and advertised and created spaces, pilgrimage spaces, for these, as it were, familiar, customary products and services in very new and often deeply industrialized ways by making use of vernacular printing, steamships, railroads, advertisements, you name it. And it was really that outreach to this new group of demand in the marketplace brought in through mass migration to the city from across the Indian Ocean and also across various parts of India, of, in many ways, the larger demographic in the marketplace of deracinated, often former rural Muslims who wanted, as it were, needed the solace of recognizable religious forms and religious services that could help them in their new lives. Forms of, as it were, religious community, gathering around a shrine. For example, religious festivity at the great, often drunken and bacchanalian Muslim saintly shrine festivals as documented in Bombay. And of course, also the miracles that they need to cope with daily life. They need miracles to help them get jobs. They need, when they're, of course, surviving as day laborers in factories and dockyards, they need miracles to cure their sick wives or children. They need miracles to help them have a baby boy to bring in income to the household when they're older. And those are the kind of services that the customary, the enchanted religious firms are able to supply much more effectively than the reformists, whose whole theological commitment is there are no miracles in Islam. So, of course, that might be, as it were, much more modern, but in that marketplace, of course, it was much less attractive.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about the area that you're studying here is its cosmopolitanness, right? It's bringing in lots and lots of different people, which really creates that diversity of demand. Everybody has a different flavor of their religion. And so, you know, it's up to these suppliers, the imams, to say, hey, you know, there's a group of people that want some religion, and that's the kind of stuff that I supply. So let me figure out how to reach these different folks at the time. A couple other factors that you mentioned in your book play an important role here too at the time, and that's the role of religious deregulation or a laissez-faire approach that the British had toward the religious marketplace, and also the influx of Christian missionaries. Talk about those two factors and how that also shaped the religious landscape of this multiplicity of Imams, or of Islams, from reformism to customary Islam.
Absolutely, Tony. This is really, really crucial. In many ways, that's why I think Bombay's story is so important, because it tells us a great deal about ongoing processes in other liberal religious economies, that's to say, religious in states where, in countries where the state doesn't play a dominating role in choosing the religious life of its citizens, states like the United States, like Britain, like Western Europe, but in fact states that are unlike many of the state-dominated religious economies and monopolistic religious economies in the Islamic world today. So what's going on then in the 19th century is that as British rule rolls out across the Indian subcontinent in the 19th century, an earlier mercantilist and actually very pragmatic and practical East India Company commercial concern was saying, effectively, we're here to make money. We're here to do business. We're not in here to tell you what to do with your religion or to get involved with any of that complicated stuff. We're here to make money. Do what you like. As the 19th century goes on, and as I said, the East India Company, and from 1858, the British Raj, actually becomes a political rather than a purely commercial entity. That older commercial imperative becomes a political and indeed in many ways an ideological imperative. The British Raj, indeed, in 1858, when Queen Victoria takes over, as it were, as being kind of the head of the Indian Empire rather than the director of the East India Company, being that, the claim is made, and indeed this becomes pretty much kind of government policy, that the British Raj of the British Empire, that the ruling state, will not interfere with the religious lives of its citizens. Now, of course, partly that's propaganda value, of course. It helps to justify religious rule and actually indeed helps to maintain it. But, of course, there's a great deal of truth in that. There's laissez-faire in the language of economics approach to religious life. Of course, that wasn't always the case. There's never been any kind of perfectly laissez-faire economy, whether commercial or economic. But this was, in many ways, the British Empire was in many ways true to its word in that way of trying not to get involved, because it helped its justification for rule, and of course it also kind of simplified matters. So what, as in one of the basic principles of religious economy, the theory of religious economy, as you know far better than I do, is that insofar as the state steps away from regulating religious transactions in the region that it controls, insofar as the state steps away from the marketplace, so to speak, the market and the region in question will have more diverse forms of religious life, because the state isn't trying to monopolize, control, and render uniform one type of religiosity. So uniform, as it were, state-dominated religious economy would be, let's say, Catholic Spain of the 16th century, when you've got, you know, kind of state apparatus, state church apparatus, like an Inquisition, making sure that there are no Jewish people, there are no Muslims, and there's not even any Protestants.
Right.
You know, that's, as it were, one example of a state-dominated religious economy. What we're dealing with here is a laissez-faire one, when the state says, no, you do what you like. Now, one of the unexpected consequences of that, in fact, was that it also allowed Christian missionaries, particularly Protestant missionaries, to enter India. Up until 1813, in the old East India Company days, East India Company days had said to the European missionaries, the British missionaries, no, keep out of here. You're just going to come and stir trouble. We don't want you here. But as the 19th century rolled on, which coincided with the rise of the great Protestant missionary societies, the Bible Society, the Church and Mission Society, the many, many of them, indeed the great American mission societies, who were among the first to turn up in Bombay as well, you know, after 1813. So what effectively happened through this laissez-faire approach is it doesn't only allow Hindus and Muslims and Zoroastrians and Sikhs in India to get on with their religious lives, it also allows significant numbers of Christian missionaries, American as well as British and German, and Danish and various others to turn up in India, particularly in Bombay. Now, what I argue in the book is that the Christian missionaries and the Protestant missionaries have a catalyzing effect on the marketplace. They don't manage to convert a vast number of people, and certainly they only manage to convert a small number of Muslims, but they have a catalytic effect because they introduce very innovative religious technologies, as I call them, or religious techniques. One of them is vernacular printing, printing religious literature, whether scriptures, the Bible, or works that are attacking Islam, attacking Hinduism, in local languages. Now, this is when this starts to begin, in around 1813, this is absolutely devastating because until approximately 1815, and in any significant way until around 1850, nowhere in the Muslim world are Muslims printing anything, apart from one father and son in Istanbul in the 18th century. So the arrival of these Christian missionaries who were not only printing, but printing in local vernacular languages and printing tens of thousands of texts, that has what I describe as a catalytic effect in the marketplace, a demonstration effect, as you've described it, by showing Muslim religious entrepreneurs or would-be religious entrepreneurs what they can do. And indeed, it has the same effect on Hindus and Parsis and Sikhs and others as well. The other thing that the Christian missionaries do is that they introduce new forms of religious organization, the idea and the model of the mission itself. Indeed, the very word mission, the English word mission, goes into Urdu at this time, mission. And the word and indeed the model of organizing a mission with, let's say, voluntary subscriptions, with people investing in it, paying for its activities, of sending out dedicated full-time propagationists to preach at certain places, in marketplaces, at fairs, at religious festivals, distributing printed vernacular literature, helping among the poor, not only trying to convert the rich, like in the old days of Indo-Islamic history, but focusing upon this new demographic of the urban industrial poor, an adaptation that the Christian missionaries had taken from places like my home city in England of Birmingham, adapted from then, as it were, the unpious Christians of Birmingham and Manchester to the, as it were, unpious Muslims and, as it were, the damned heathens, as the Christians saw them in Bombay. Yeah. So this has a really, really important catalytic and, indeed, as you mentioned, a demonstration effect. So this is really the second really important factor, religious deregulation and then the coming of the Christian missionaries. And the third factor, then, is diverse market demand. All this would have been all very well, but, of course, this is really the state providing a certain type of religious marketplace. It's a certain type of supply, but what about the demand? And as I mentioned, Bombay in the 19th century, because of its industrialization, sees these vast and very diverse groups of Muslims arriving from all around the Indian Ocean and all across the Indian subcontinent as well. And, of course, these figures are not only, as it were, migrants who are bringing demand, but a number of them will also be migrants bringing supply. They become new religious entrepreneurs who will set up new firms. And the most effective ones are the ones who adopt and adapt the techniques introduced by the Christian missionaries, the new form of organization of the mission, the new form of religious propaganda through vernacular printing, and indeed making use of new distribution technologies of steamships and trains, and indeed photographs and other modern and industrial forms of communication as well.
And lo and behold, instead of getting a general standardized form of religiosity, as many of the old sociological models would predict, we get this panoply of multiplicity of different religious organizations. Very interesting. One of the things that your work has done beyond Bombay Islam is to talk about this beyond the borders of India. And you talk about that you can't just look at country studies as a historian because countries are affected by things that happen all the way around them. Go ahead and tell us about some of your more recent research where you take your understanding of the globalizations of Islam beyond the borders of Bombay and India.
Absolutely. I think one of the things to bear in mind as I do that is that even though I've looked on a world scale from, let's say, Japan to the United States, I've often tried to keep India or South Asia, India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, as it is now, in the picture. And the simple reason for that is sometimes very often forgotten. most people tend to think that Islam, that's about the Middle East.
Yeah.
But the Muslim population of South Asia, New Pakistan, Bangladesh, hugely outnumbers that of the Middle East. And indeed, according to recent Pew Foundation predictions, soon India, not only Pakistan, but India will have the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, including Indonesia, and way larger than anywhere in the Middle East. We're talking kind of, you know, the largest Muslim population in the world. That was already taking place in the 19th century, and the trajectories I trace as I look at global Islam, from Bombay Islam to my book, Terrains of Exchange, are really processes that are going on today. And what those processes are is actually, in a way, trying to put this much bigger demographic of Muslim South Asia into world history, and to say, well, the center, the demographic center, but also in many ways the religious center of the Islamic world, in many ways is South Asia. And what I look at with my work on, let's say, on Burma in the 19th century, my book, Terrains of Exchange, looking at religious economies from the United States, as I say, to Japan, is the role of Indian religious entrepreneurs going global. In the Bombay book, I talked, as it were, about the local adaptation in India and in the Indian Ocean of these proselytizing techniques borrowed from Christian missionaries. In my work in Terrains of Exchange, I show how, as the 19th century became the 20th century, Indian religious entrepreneurs, what we would now call, let's say, Indo-Pakistani religious entrepreneurs, or indeed Bangladeshi religious entrepreneurs, start to use those propagatory and missionary evangelical techniques, no less, to spread throughout the world, throughout Britain, I talked about in the 19th century, and indeed to the United States. The first mosque, I give two kind of case studies in Terrains of Exchange, of the first mosque founded in the United States, or rather the first purpose-built mosque established in the United States in Highland Park, Michigan, just outside Detroit, in 1921, and the first purpose-built mosque founded in Japan around a decade later in the port city of Kobe. And what I show in both cases is the really important role of South Asian, Indo-Pakistani missionaries and missionary firms in setting up these mosques, and indeed of setting up evangelical movements in these countries. So looking at the case of Detroit, again, there's an interesting case because there's already a Muslim community in Detroit, which were laborers at the Ford factory. The first mosque was right opposite the Highland Park Ford factory with its, you know, kind of pioneering assembly line. And even though that mosque had been built by a Lebanese-American real estate developer, the first imam that comes there was actually an Indian Muslim who belonged to a very important worldwide Muslim missionary organization, the Ahmadiyya organization, the Ahmadiyya Jamaat. And what this figure tried to do, this Muslim missionary tried to do in the United States, was to convert large numbers of Americans. In fact, he was particularly successful in converting several thousand Americans, particularly African Americans, in the 1920s to Islam by using the very techniques of the Christian missionaries. In fact, he very often actually was going around preaching in church halls by saying, I've come to talk about Jesus, but then revealing that Jesus was a Muslim prophet, and the true Muslim prophet was, of course, Muhammad, who succeeded Jesus. So again, using the very techniques of Christian missionaries. He wrote an Urdu autobiography, and that was my source, taking this transnational Urdu look on American religious history. In the case of Japan, it was rather similar in the foundation of the first mosque there as well by Indian investors, with the aim partly of serving existing Muslims there, but partly of the mosque serving as it were, the base for the conversion of Japan, which is very well documented, as I show in the text. That doesn't happen in Japan for the simple reason that by 1940, a decade after the mosque was founded, the Indians are expelled for being British citizens. Of course, the Britons are at war with Japan at that point. And indeed, after the 1940s, with the closing of international borders in World War II, the world I describe in Terrains of Exchange comes to an end. But of course, it's not an end. It's really a moment of 50 years delay during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. By the 1990s, with the opening of borders and the re-globalization processes that happen from the end of the 20th century, we see that the religious Muslim religious firms that I describe in Terrains of Exchange hadn't gone away during the Cold War. They just hadn't been noticed so much when Western scholars were devoted to modernization theory and indeed devoted to the spread of communism. Mm-hmm. These Muslim religious firms that indeed continue to go global, so that when we had the opening of borders again in the 1990s, various Muslim religious firms, including religious firms such as the Tablighi Jamaat, founded in the 1920s in India, were spreading further and further worldwide, in many ways using the same techniques that I described in my religious entrepreneur in 1920s Detroit using that time, which is taking hold of existing religious organizations, religious institutions, particularly mosques, and using those mosques as public platforms to spread their own particular version of Islam and to outcompete other, often more liberal, forms of Islam in the religious marketplace. And that might be happening in America, in Britain, as it indeed is in places like Pakistan and India and across the Middle East. So the same processes then that I describe, global processes of religious economy, of religious competition, religious exchange that I describe in my book, Terrains of Exchange, of course, recommends with a vengeance, one might say, in the even more globalized world that opens up in the 1990s.
Yeah, I want to focus on that just a little bit more, because one of the questions I always love to ask historians is that, you know, all this stuff that you learned in the 19th century, early 20th century, it tells us about our lives today as human beings. We learn a great deal from the past. What kind of lessons are you drawing from all of this historical work for our understanding of what is going on here in 2016, the early 21st century, and perhaps projecting that a little bit into the next few decades?
I think the principles of religious economy and the processes that it shows of interaction, of competition, of adaptation, show very much what is happening in across the Islamic world today and indeed across Europe and the wider world as well. Now, of course, having devoted most of my scholarly life and most of my output to writing about the history of Sufism, indeed, writing about, let's say, the history of more liberal or more cosmopolitan, more pluralistic forms of Islam, I'm very much aware that the Sufis never went away. There were still millions of people in South Asia that visit Sufi shrines to this day. But what I have realized very clearly through my own travels in the Indian subcontinent and throughout the entire Islamic world is that as the 20th century wears on and into the 21st century, that religious firms that were led by Sufis and older Sufi organizations, they were outcompeted and increasingly are being outcompeted by new types of religious firm and new types of entrepreneur. We can broadly call some of those new types of religious entrepreneur Salafists. We might call them, some of them, Wahhabis. We might call some of them, or indeed one of the most famous religious firm in the world today, of course, is ISIS. Now, of course, they aren't the entire picture. There are indeed many Muslims throughout the world who would love to continue following their Sufi and indeed perhaps their more liberal forms of Islam. But those religious organizations and those religious firms are being outcompeted by, as it were, these Salafist and indeed in some cases Wahhabi religious firms, not least because now we're in a position when we have very wealthy Arab oil states, for example, like Saudi Arabia, who deeply invest, who bankroll some of these Salafist and Wahhabi religious firms. So my point is the model of religious economy is not about Muslims altogether and what Islam is or not. Religious economy shows us that religion, Islam, is constantly being reinvented, constantly being renegotiated, constantly being redefined, constantly being redeployed by religious entrepreneurs, by suppliers. Now, in the process of increasing competition in a global marketplace, we'll see that those forms of competition, and indeed of inter-Muslim competition, competition between different Muslim religious firms, increasingly become violent. And that's all the more the case in the most deregulated religious economies of all, which are in places of collapsed states, places like Afghanistan in the 1990s that gave rise to the Taliban, and indeed Iraq and increasingly Syria in the present day. Deregulated religious economies where through state collapse, the most violent forms of religious competition emerge. And organizations like ISIS are classic examples of hybrid religious firms led by religious entrepreneurs who are very effective in using not the vernacular printing of the 19th century, but similar techniques adapted from the West and similar technologies adapted from California, no less, such as the iPhone and Facebook. So what we see going on in the world today, the rise of ISIS, the rise of many copycat, even lone religious entrepreneurs committed to religious violence, the most, as it were, frightening and most visible form of religious competition, are again entirely products of the processes I describe in my work. And indeed, I think it's really very important. This isn't an advertisement for my own work at all. I think the model of religious economy, and whoever takes it up, I hope much more effectively than I have, can actually use this model and these analytical techniques to show us what is happening in the world around us, and perhaps show us ways of undermining those violent and Salafist religious entrepreneurs, and perhaps helping to promote religious entrepreneurs of a more liberal and Sufi kind, who have been outcompeted in so many of the marketplaces around the Islamic world, indeed around the world in general.
Yes, definitely taking the lessons of history and applying them to today is something that you do very well. And your books are wonderful examples of how we can understand the human condition that way. I want to leave off with one last question I always like to ask my guests, and that's scholarship is a journey. And yours is a very interesting journey. As you mentioned, you got into this whole business by just hopping on a train and heading out to Istanbul when you're 17 years old and just experiencing the world firsthand. Along that journey, has there been any major surprise or surprises that really made you change your mind about who we are as a society, who we are as a species?
I think so. I mean, it's a cliche I'm using. One's life is a journey. My life has been, I think, a moral, spiritual, and intellectual journey. Throughout the many years I spent traveling throughout the Islamic world, I must say, there are a few incidents. I've had bullets whiz past my ear. I've been actually on sidelines involved with Al-Qaeda kidnappings and murders. But for the most part, my travels throughout the Islamic world were experiences of the greatest hospitality and the greatest friendship and the greatest openness from Muslims I met from places from Syria to Afghanistan to Pakistan to Iran. I never stayed in fancy hotels. I stayed just as a guest overnight with whoever I happened to bump into in towns I would travel in or be hitchhiking through the mountains and villages of Syria or whatever it would be. And yet, and this is how, as it were, a moral journey became for me an intellectual journey to get to the heart of your question, I wanted to understand how it was that those societies and those people and those communities who were so humane and so generous and so open-minded to me as an individual could collapse into the sectarian and religious violence that we see in so many countries to this day. And that's when the model of religious economy, the role of the religious entrepreneur, the role of religious competition, helped me explain a crisis for me as well as a person, that how countries which I had loved and traveled to and spent my whole youth making friends in had fallen into such dystopian times. And I think really that is, I think, tremendously important. It's important for me as an individual. And I think that, if anything, I think is the lesson I have learned as well.
Well, it is a lesson that comes through in all of your work. And we will recommend listeners to your books. You can see them on our website. We will link to a number of them. My guest today has been Niall Green. Niall, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony, for wonderful set of questions, and thank you all listeners for bearing with me this far. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.